of the UDC's teachings has contributed to the country's collective ahistoricism and has helped shape the ongoing landscape of white supremacy today. During our conversation, Jeff had shared with me what Blanford Cemetery meant to him and why it was so important to his sense of self. So in turn, I wanted to share with him what it felt like for me to be here. I told him that because my ancestors were enslaved and because the Confederacy had fought a war to preserve slavery, it was difficult for me to have much empathy for the Confederates and places like Blanford, which paid tribute to the cause they fought for. "Well, if you ever read the letters," Jeff said, "it was actually written. You can find them if you look. Read the letters of Lincoln himself, what he said about slavery. He did not want blacks to hold office, and as far as he's concerned, he kept them where they belong or sent them overseas." Lincoln did have a complicated history with slavery and his stance on emancipation. As historian Eric Foner notes, while Lincoln said that he had always hated slavery and called the institution a monstrous injustice, his commitment to ending slavery was not necessarily matched by his commitment to black equality. While some abolitionists saw the desire to end slavery and build a racially egalitarian society as inextricably linked, Lincoln thought of them as distinct. In a September 18, 1858 speech, as part of his fourth senatorial debate with Stephen A. Douglas, Lincoln claimed, "I will say that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." In fact, for much of his political career, Lincoln was a public advocate of colonization, a plan he pushed for throughout the first half of the Civil War. The idea behind colonization, sometimes called expatriation, the same plan that Jefferson advocated, was that it would be better for both white and black people if the latter emigrated and resettled in another country, either in Central America, the Caribbean, or Africa. Lincoln thought that abolition paired with colonization was the best path forward, as it ostensibly gave black people freedom and removed the concern that many Americans had about having to live alongside their black counterparts. On August 14, 1862, Lincoln brought a group of free black leaders to the White House in an attempt to convince them to lead a resettlement plan in present-day Panama. The proposal was not met with enthusiasm by the visitors and was roundly rejected by other black leaders who saw themselves as every bit as American as Lincoln when accounts were published in the press. Frederick Douglass scathed Lincoln, saying, "The President of the United States seems to possess an ever-increasing passion for making himself appear silly and ridiculous, if nothing worse." While some supporters of colonization suggested that millions of free black people posed a threat to the social order, Lincoln claimed that his support was rooted in a fear of white racism. According to Lincoln, white racism was so deeply entrenched that black people would never have the chance to be equal members of society. Lincoln's position was similar to many throughout the North, those who believed slavery should be abolished, but who did not want to share society with or live alongside free black Americans. As Foner notes, for many white Americans, including Lincoln, colonization represented a middle ground between the radicalism of the abolitionists and the prospect of the United States existing permanently half slave and half free. It should be noted that Lincoln's position began to change after signing the Emancipation Proclamation and after seeing 200,000 black soldiers fight on behalf of the Union. A few days before his assassination, he endorsed the prospect of limited suffrage for certain groups of black people, albeit those he deemed, quote, "very intelligent, and who serve our cause as soldiers." There is evidence that Lincoln's position was continuing to evolve on the issue, but because of his untimely assassination after the end of the Civil War, we will never know for sure where he might have ended up. Is Jeff wrong that Lincoln advocated black inferiority and colonization during a significant portion of his political career? No. The issue, however, is not necessarily the veracity of his comments, but the attempt to use Lincoln's record to obscure the fact that, as the war evolved, Lincoln was in charge of an army that was fighting to free 4 million black people, while the other side fought to keep them enslaved. Over the course of my conversation with Jeff, the shade of the gazebo had moved and exposed our faces to the hot sun. I could feel the pearls of sweat emerge on my temple and slide down my cheek before getting lost in the forest of my beard. A pair of children were running up and down the hill, resisting their mother's call for them to move toward their car. The wreath that had been placed at the foot of the Confederate statue leaned against the gray stone, the tails of the ribbons tied around them, rising and falling with the breeze. Jeff stepped away, and a few minutes later I began speaking with a woman and her son, a thin 20-year-old, with glasses and patches of black beard dotting his jawline. I had noticed the young man as one of the people dressed in Confederate regalia as part of the honor guard. "I was actually a last-minute recruit," he said, introducing himself as Nicholas, his voice quick and nasally. "I didn't even have my gun loaded. The last time I dressed up as a Confederate was 6 years ago, and that was at Pamplin Park, when I was 14 years old and having fun," he said. I asked Nicholas what it felt like to dress up in Confederate regalia, wondering if it reflected his allegiance to any particular side or narrative. "I guess what it is, even though I'm more sympathetic to the Union side than the Confederate side, at the end of the day, I still think that both sides were brave men who deserve to be remembered. So that's what I was doing here." As I was speaking with Nicholas and his mother, another man dressed in Confederate garb, though much older than Nicholas, approached us and stood a few feet away. I watched him from the corner of my eye, but he was not hiding the fact that he was listening in. It was unclear if he was trying to intimidate me or if he was genuinely trying to join in on the conversation. "How about yourself?" I said, turning to him, preferring to address him directly rather than having him ominously hovering behind us. "Have you been participating in these sorts of things for a while?" "Since I was 19. "And how old are you now?" Nicholas's mother asked from behind me. 48, he said. I turned more fully toward him, introducing myself and getting his name. Jason. I asked him what this event and what dressing up as a Confederate soldier meant for him. "This time period, this 61 to 65, this is my focus. If you look at my library, it's almost exclusively Civil War, other than children's books for my kids. This time period, it just gripped me." He continued, "I took a class on Civil War history, and from that, someone had mentioned to me, you know, what I'd like to have for a job is one of those Civil War reenactors. That would be a cool job, right? I didn't realize it's all volunteer." He laughed, Nicholas and his mother joining in. "Are you similar to Nicholas in the sense that you're interested and kind of sympathetic to both sides?" I asked. "I understand both sides. I understand their way of thinking. Both sides. I will be honest, I am more sympathetic toward the Southern cause, and there's so much more to it than what is taught in schools today." I asked him what he was taught in relation to what he believed the more holistic truth was. "It is the, how do I put this gently? People are not as educated as they should be. People are growing up being taught the Civil War is all about slavery, okay? Then they grow up and they teach younger people, and then they grow up. And if that's all you hear every single day, you know, and someone comes up to me and I say, well, that's not exactly true, let's talk about this. And they just think I'm crazy. No way. That's like me saying," and he pointed his finger at his chest, "this is not really a shirt." "So were you taught that slavery growing up was the central cause of the Civil War?" I asked. "That's what the textbooks say," he said. I asked Jason what he believed the actual cause was. "Now see, that's a whole conversation," he said. "It's so hard to just put that in a little 5-second blurb." "It's complicated," said Nicholas's mother, a departing word before she and Nicholas excused themselves. "I will tell you this. I've done a lot of research because I'm interested," Jason said. "They've been taught all their life that the Confederates are racist, that this was a war over slavery. These men were fighting to keep slavery legal. And if that's what you grow up believing, you're looking at people like me wearing this uniform. Oh," He's a racist. We used to be able to stand on the monuments on Monument Avenue, those Lee and Jackson monuments. We can't do it anymore, because it ain't safe. Someone's going to drive by and shoot me, you know? That's what I'm afraid of. I'm not standing out there for a racist reason. I thought it was unlikely that someone would shoot Jason for standing in front of a Confederate monument. In fact, groups and individuals far more extreme than the Sons of Confederate Veterans, white nationalists, neo-Nazis, and others with obviously hateful views, have received an astonishing amount of protection over the past several years from police officers preserving their right to free speech, even when it cost the city millions of dollars to do so. But there was also an irony in Jason's admission of fear. These monuments had been erected decades ago with the intention of rewriting history and instilling fear in black communities. And now, it was Jason who felt scared to stand in front of the same monuments. He then pointed to a man down the hill to our right. "See this large man standing right over here?" he said. "He was the captain of my reenacting group. He recruited me into this hobby. He's in an international," he paused, "interracial is the word I'm looking for, marriage." He looked at the man. Anybody who doesn't know him is going to say he's racist. But then when you see his wife, you may have a different perception. You know what I'm saying? While it certainly is not true that being in an interracial relationship means that someone can't be racist, it didn't feel like an issue worth pushing back on for the time being because I wanted to continue to hear what Jason thought about the war. I asked Jason whether, through the process of his research, he had found anything that suggested the reason the Southern states seceded was tied to slavery. "No," he said. "I will say there were politicians who will have very racist quotes, and you can look it up. There were probably large landowners who felt threatened by this talk. What? They want to get rid of slavery? Well, I can't do this job without the slavery. So I'm not saying that it didn't exist. That's the narrative. But as far as going to war and putting them through the absolute hell that these men went through, why would they do that? The average age was 17 to 22 for a Civil War soldier. Many of them had never even seen a black man. The rich were the ones who had slaves. They didn't have to fight. They were draft exempt. So these men are going to be out here, and they're going to be laying down their lives and fighting and going through the hell of camp life, the lice, the rats, and everything else, just so this rich dude in Richmond, Virginia, or Atlanta, Georgia, or Memphis, Tennessee, can have some slaves? That doesn't make sense. To me, it's common sense. No man would do that. The historian Joseph T. Glattar has challenged the argument that Confederate soldiers couldn't have fought because of slavery since very few were slave owners. He analyzed the makeup of soldiers in the unit that would become Lee's Army of Northern Virginia and pointed out that the vast majority of the volunteers of 1861 had a direct connection to slavery. In 1861, almost half of those Confederate soldiers either owned enslaved people or lived with a head of household who did, and many more worked for slaveholders, rented land from them, and had business relationships with them. There is also ample evidence that white Southerners who did not own enslaved people were often still deeply committed to preserving the institution. Historian James Oliver Horton wrote of how the press inundated white Southerners with messages of why fighting to prevent the abolition of slavery was essential to preventing enslaved and formerly enslaved people from, in the words of the Louisville Daily Courier, rising, quote, to the level of the white race. Without slavery, these papers argued, there would be no difference between poor whites and free blacks. The Louisville Daily Courier warned non-slaveholding white Southerners about the slippery slope of abolition and the dangers of racial equality. Do they wish to send their children to schools in which the Negro children of the vicinity are taught? Do they wish to give the Negro the right to appear in the witness box to testify against them? The paper did not stop there and went right to the issue it knew animated the most fear and fervor among white Southern men. Would non-slaveholding white men accept a society in which they amalgamate together the two races in violation of God's will? Propaganda like this helped convince non-slaveholding whites that abolition was an existential threat to Southern society. Without slavery, they were told, they would be forced to live, work, and inevitably procreate with their free black neighbors. This was a proposition that millions of Southern whites were unwilling to accept. Horton finds plenty of examples of Confederate soldiers saying this for themselves. As he notes, one Southern prisoner of war told the Union soldier standing watch, "You Yanks want us to marry our daughters to niggers." An indigent white farmer from North Carolina said that he could not and would not stop fighting because Lincoln's government was trying to force us to live as a colored race. A Confederate artilleryman from Louisiana said that his army had to fight even against difficult odds because he would never want to see the day when a Negro is put on an equality with a white person. In his book, The Peculiar Institution, Slavery in the Antebellum South, historian Kenneth M. Stamp contended that the white Southerners who did not own slaves still actively supported the institution as, quote, a means of controlling the social and economic competition of Negroes, concrete evidence of membership in a superior caste, a chance, perhaps, to rise into the planter class. Or as historian Charles Dew says, if you are white in the antebellum South, there is a floor below which you cannot go. You have a whole population of 4 million people whom you consider, and your society considers, inferior to you. You don't have to be actively involved in the system to derive at least the psychological benefits of the system. White Southerners' commitment to the Confederate cause was not predicated on whether or not they owned slaves. The commitment was based on a desire to maintain a society in which black people remained at the bottom of the social hierarchy. A man I had seen in my periphery, speaking with my friend William, walked up to Jason and me. We shook hands as he and Jason greeted each other with warm familiarity. "He's a treasure trove of information too," Jason said, pointing to the man. I mentioned that I had seen him talking to my friend on the other side of the gazebo. "I've been in his ear good, and I gave William my telephone number if you need anything else," he said. I thanked him and told him that was very generous. He looked at me, his eyes searching my face. His face shifted. I told him, "If you write about my ancestors..." The air was now trembling between us. He leaned in closer. "I want it to be correct. I'm concerned about the truth, not mythology." A few weeks earlier, after my first visit to Blandford, I had driven 30 minutes north to Richmond. When I arrived at Monument Avenue, I double-parked my car across the street, put my blinkers on, and walked toward the statue of Robert E. Lee a few hundred feet away. I craned my neck to see Lee's statue awash in sunlight, its bronze hue glimmering in the rays of late afternoon. The sculpture was enormous, a 21-foot-tall statue thrust into the sky by a 40-foot white stone base. Lee sat in a magisterial position atop his horse, his general's uniform fastened tightly around his torso, the bottom of his jacket draped across his upper legs. I stood there, looking up at the statue long enough to feel its shadow move like a sundial around me, scanning its frame from the bottom of the pedestal to the top of Lee's head. This statue of Lee was not so different from the one I had grown up around. I was born and raised in a city filled with statues of Confederate soldiers, white men on pedestals and black children playing beneath them, where black people played trumpets and trombones to drown out the Dixie song that still whistled in the wind. In my hometown of New Orleans, there are at least 100 streets, statues, parks, and schools named after Confederate figures, slave owners, and defenders of slavery. For decades, black children have walked into buildings named after people who thought of them as property. My own middle school, Lusher, is named after Robert Mills Lusher, a Confederate and former Louisiana superintendent of education who fought against desegregation and who believed in the supremacy of the Caucasian race. Every time I returned home, I would drive on streets named for those who thought of me as chattel. Go straight for 2 miles on Robert E. Lee, take a left on Jefferson Davis, make the first right on Claiborne, translation, go straight for 2 miles on the general whose troops slaughtered hundreds of black soldiers who were trying to surrender, take a left on the president of the Confederacy who understood the torture of black bodies as the cornerstone of their new nation, make the first right on the man who allowed the heads of rebelling slaves to be mounted on stakes in order to prevent other slaves from getting any ideas. So much of the story we tell about history is really about the story that we tell about ourselves, about our mothers, and our fathers, and their mothers, and their fathers, as far back as our lineages will take us. Throughout our lives, we are told certain stories, and they are stories that we choose to believe. Stories that become embedded in our identities in ways we are not always fully cognizant of. For many of the people I met at Blandford, the story of the Confederacy is the story of their home, of their family, and the story of their family is the story about them. So when they are asked to reckon with the fact that their ancestors fought a war to keep my ancestors enslaved, there is resistance to facts that have been documented by primary sources and contemporaneous evidence. They are forced to confront the lies they have upheld. They are forced to confront the flaws of their ancestors. As Greg Stewart, a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, told the New York Times in the aftermath of the 2015 Charleston massacre, "You're asking me to agree that my great-grandparent and great-great-grandparents were monsters. Accepting such a reality would, for them, mean the deterioration of a narrative that has long been a part of their lineage, and the disintegration of so much of who they believed themselves to be in the world. But as I think of Blandford, I'm left wondering if we are all just patchworks of the stories we've been told. What would it take? What does it take for you to confront a false history, even if it means having to fundamentally re-examine who you are and who your family has been? Just because something is difficult to accept doesn't mean you should refuse to accept it. Just because someone tells you a story doesn't make that story true." Galveston Island, our Independence Day. The long-held myth goes that on June 19, 1865, Union General Gordon Granger stood on the balcony of Ashton Villa in Galveston, Texas, and read the order that announced the end of slavery. Though no contemporaneous evidence exists to specifically support the claim, the story of General Granger reading from the balcony embedded itself into local folklore. On this day each year, as part of Galveston's Juneteenth program, a reenactor from the Sons of Confederate Veterans reads the proclamation at Aston Villa while an audience looks on. It is an annual moment that has taken a myth and turned it into tradition. Galveston is a small island that sits off the coast of southeast Texas, and in years past, this event has taken place outside. But this year, given the summer heat, the island's humidity, and the average age of the attendees, the organizers moved the event inside. A man named Stephen Duncan, dressed as General Granger, stood at the base of the stairwell, with other men dressed as Union soldiers on either side of him. Stephen looked down at the parchment, appraising the words as if he had never seen them before. He looked back down at the crowd, who was looking back up at him. He cleared his throat, approached the microphone, and lifted the yellow parchment to eye level. "The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere." All slaves are free. The four words circled the room like birds who had been separated from their flock. I watched people's faces as Stephen said these words. Some closed their eyes. Some were physically shaking. Some clasped hands with the person next to them. Some simply smiled, soaking in the words that their ancestors may have heard more than a century and a half ago. Being in this place, standing on the same small island where the freedom of 250,000 people was proclaimed, I felt the history pulse through my body. General Granger and his forces arrived in Galveston more than 2 years after Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation and more than 2 months after Robert E. Lee's famous surrender. A document that is widely misunderstood, Lincoln's proclamation was a military strategy with multiple aims. It prevented European countries from supporting the Confederacy by framing the war in moral terms and making it explicitly about slavery, something Lincoln had previously backed away from. As a result, France and Britain, which had contemplated supporting the Confederacy, ultimately refused to do so because of each country's anti-slavery positions. The proclamation allowed the Union Army to recruit black soldiers, nearly 200,000 of whom would fight for the Union Army by the war's end, and it also threatened to disrupt the South's social order, which depended on the work and caste position of enslaved people. The Emancipation Proclamation, some forget, was not the sweeping, all-encompassing document that it is often remembered as. It applied only to the 11 Confederate states and did not include the border states that had remained loyal to the U.S., where it was still legal to own enslaved people. Despite the order of the proclamation, Texas was one of the Confederate states that ignored what it demanded. Even though many enslaved people escaped behind Union lines and enlisted in the Federal Army themselves, enslavers throughout the Confederacy continued to hold black people in bondage throughout the rest of the war. General Lee surrendered on April 9, 1865 in Appomattox County, Virginia, effectively signaling that the Confederacy had lost the war, but many enslavers in Texas did not share this news with their human property. It was on June 19, 1865, soon after arriving in Galveston, that Granger issued the announcement, known as General Order No. 3, that all slaves were free, and word began to spread throughout Texas, from plantation to plantation, farmstead to farmstead, person to person. A 92-year-old formerly enslaved man named Felix Haywood recalled with nostalgic jubilation what that day meant to him and so many others. The end of the war, it come just like that, like you snap your fingers. Hallelujah broke out. Soldiers, all of a sudden, was everywhere, coming in bunches, crossing and walking and riding. Everyone was singing. We was all on golden clouds. We was free. Just like that. We was free. The air at Ashton Villa smelled of salt and heat. The street hummed with light traffic. The residence's coral red brick facade shimmered under the summer sun. Each of the three stories of the Victorian-style house held tall, white-trimmed windows with forest green shutters that opened on either side. A cast-iron veranda extended its shadow over the walkway, leading to the front door. Completed in 1859, the villa had served as regional headquarters for both the Union and the Confederate armies during the Civil War, moving back and forth between each of them while the battles that would determine the future of Texas and of the country were won and lost. The home was built, in large part, by the labor of enslaved people. I walked inside and was grateful for the cool air. In the back of the old residence was a large, bright room. I walked in and sat down at one of the 24 round tables laid out across the long rectangular space, each blanketed by a large white cloth with its trim overhanging the edges. The ceiling was so high, it looked like it was running from the people below. A large chandelier was suspended from the middle of the room, its glass ornamentation hanging from curved silver arms, each translucent crystal glimmering under the canopy of light. A man at the front of the room was playing piano, his fingers gliding across the keys in a series of chords, a preview of each song he planned to share during the event. The room began to fill with a slow trickle, followed by a gush of limbs and smiles as the start of the program drew near. As friends, families, and neighbors saw each other, they moved enthusiastically toward the tables, hugging, shaking hands, and squealing with delight at each small reunion. Some wore Juneteenth t-shirts with Pan-African colors embedded in the designs. Some were dressed in dashikis and colorful beads. And many looked like they were on their way to a picnic. The vast majority of the people in the room were black, though a range of races and complexions were scattered throughout. The scene was similar to the beginnings of the black church services I knew as a child. It was a scene of fellowship, a sanctuary less reliant on the building it sits in than on the community it is built. Ashton Villa was brewing with the anticipation of revival. This was the 40th anniversary of Al Edwards Sr.'s Juneteenth prayer breakfast. The event has been held annually since the Texas House Bill 1016 passed in 1979. A piece of legislation championed by state legislator Al Edwards Sr. that made Juneteenth an official state holiday. I'm Major General Granger, Commanding General of the District of Texas. This morning we would like to present to you some of the history of those enslaved in the United States until this day, when they were set free. We're glad for you to be here with us. This is a very, very important day in the history of Galveston, the history of Texas, and the history of the United States. On this day, the promise of freedom became reality. A student, a young woman who looked to be about 16, walked up to the microphone holding a white placard that read, 1492. Everyone in the audience adjusted their chairs and turned their heads to get a better look. She placed the placard over the microphone, her arms extending outward so everyone in the crowd could read what it said on the front, while she read from the other side. In 1492, Europeans arrived in the Americas searching for the three G's, gold, glory, and God. Long before enslaved Africans arrived, the Spanish enslaved some of the native populations against the wishes of Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. As she pulled the placard down and walked away from the microphone and toward the wall, the man impersonating Union General Granger spoke again, setting the stage for the next young person to come up. In 1528, he said, the first non-native enslaved person arrived in Galveston. Another young woman walked to the microphone and did the same as the young woman before her. The first non-native slave in Texas was Estevanico, a Moor from North Africa. Estevanico was captured and enslaved by the Spanish when he was a child. He accompanied his master, Captain Andres Dorantes de Carranza, on the Narvaez expedition, which landed at present-day Tampa. In November of 1528, their barges went aground off the coast of Texas. Estevanico, Dorantes, and Alonso del Castillo Maldonado, the only survivors, spent several months living on a barrier island, now believed to be Galveston Island, before making their way in April of 1529 to the mainland. The man in the Union Army uniform spoke again. In 1619, the first enslaved Africans arrived. It continued on like this for several minutes, student after student coming up to the microphone, providing a parade of facts in chronological order, leading the listener up to June 19, 1865. Juneteenth. The students, who ranged from elementary-age children to teenagers, had come from the NIA Cultural Center's Freedom School. The program, part of an initiative run by the Children's Defense Fund, offers 6 weeks of summer enrichment programming for young people with a specific focus on helping them understand their relationship to history. I watched these young people read to the audience parts of history that placed our country in context. I felt, in that moment, envious of them. Had I known when I was younger some of what these students were sharing, I felt as if I would have been liberated from a social and emotional paralysis that for so long I could not name. A paralysis that had arisen from never knowing enough of my own history to effectively identify the lies I was being told by others. Lies about what slavery was and what it did to our people. Lies about what came after our supposed emancipation. Lies about why our country looks the way that it does today. I had grown up in a world that never tired of telling me and other black children like me all the things that were wrong with us, all the things that we needed to do better. But not enough people spoke about the reason so many black children grow up in communities saturated with poverty and violence. Not enough people spoke about how these realities were the result of decisions made by people in power and had existed generations before us. After college, when I was doing more reading of my own, I began to understand all that has happened to our communities, to our people, over generations. It was liberating. I had language to name what I felt but had never known how to say. People sometimes believe that if they talk to black youth about the historical legacy of slavery and the intergenerational iterations of systemic racism that followed, that young people will feel overwhelmed and shut down. But there is enormous value in providing young people with the language, the history, and the framework to identify why their society looks the way that it does. Understanding that all of this was not done by accident, but by design. That did not strip me of agency. It gave agency back to me. I watched these young people share this history, and I dreamed of what it might mean if we could extend these lessons to every child. How different might our country look if all of us fully understood what had happened here? As a group of younger children was preparing to sing, I continued to watch from my end of the room. A small white woman helped to gather the children and put them in their correct positions, moving with a mix of purpose and freneticism, and then looking on with unfettered pride as they sang to the packed room. Kathy Tiernan had a puff of graying brown hair and wore a large pair of frameless glasses. Her eyes tilted down at their edges, giving them an air of empathy and warmth. She wore a long, colorful necklace of beads, that hung over a faded Juneteenth t-shirt from a previous year's celebration. She has helped organize the program for a decade now, and has seen it evolve from a smattering of disparate competing events to a more cohesive community celebration. Kathy has been central to ensuring that the next generation of Galvestonians understands the importance of Juneteenth. I'm going to tell you that about 4 years ago, as I looked around the crowd for this Juneteenth breakfast, I saw a lot of older people were not returning, she told me later. And just like our churches, people were dying off, and their three or four friends who brought them weren't coming back. And I thought, we need to get kids involved. And that's when I invited Sue Johnson, who is the director of the Freedom School and the head of the Neo Cultural Center, to get her college interns involved in telling more about this day in history. What Kathy loved most is this project of community education. Older kids teaching younger kids, kids teaching adults, and vice versa. Learning models that break down and break out of our traditional conceptions of what education should look like. For me, to see this room full of people, to watch their faces when the kids are singing, to see them nod when they hear about a piece of history that they maybe hadn't thought about for a while, or are hearing really for the first time, that's a real thrill to me. And when people, more people whose story it is, get involved in their own story, things change. Things change for the better all the time. Not with a group of just blacks doing this. That doesn't work. It's got to be the community involved in this, because that's what made the change. It didn't happen isolated. It happened when blacks worked together, and whites worked together, and Hispanics worked together. That's when things work, when we all understand, participate, and care about each other's story. And that's what brings me joy. Once the children finished singing, Reverend Lewis Simpson Jr., pastor of St. John Missionary Baptist Church, came up to the podium and led the group in prayer. Leaning on his cane, nodding his head as if it were being lifted and released by an invisible string above him, he outlined the parallels between God's freeing of the Israelites and the freedom achieved by enslaved black people in America, a parallel that had been long made by black ministers both during and after slavery. You led us out of captivity, and for that, Father, all of us, he lifted his head, just say, thank you. I looked around to see every person's head bowed in prayer as devotional ad-libs cascaded across the room. After Reverend Simpson stepped down, the pianist, who had been playing lightly in the background of the prayer, seamlessly transitioned into the beginning of the melody for Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem. Originally written as a poem by James Weldon Johnson to celebrate the birthday of the late President Abraham Lincoln, the poem evolved into a song, and the song evolved into something much larger than a tribute to any singular figure. Scholar Imani Perry, in her book about the origins of the song, May We Forever Stand, writes that it was a lament, an encomium to the story and struggle of black people that ultimately became a definitive part of the ritual practices in schools and churches and civic gatherings. Without anyone having to ask, everyone in the room stood up. Some held pieces of paper with the song lyrics, but the majority stood simply with their eyes shut and their hands clasped. They did not need to read the words. Their bodies swayed and their lips moved to a hymn that had long been imprinted in their memories. I half sang and half looked around the room, observing the way people's mouths moved over the words, how the vowels at the center of each lyric stretched out and hung like the laundry on a warm day. Around me was a tapestry of sunlight and song, pain and catharsis moving through the air. As I listened to people sing, I imagined the words floating above us, my eyes tracing the curve of each invisible piece of language, while the chords from the piano echoed throughout the room. I felt almost as if I should reach up and grab the words and place them in my pocket, in an effort to carry this moment with me once it came to an end. When we reached the second verse, I felt something different come over the crowd, and felt something different come over me. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered, out from the gloomy past, till now we stand at last, where the white gleam of our bright star is cast. The crowd had turned into a congregation. My own lips, after an initial wariness, curled around each slice of song and found a home there. I'd sung the Black National Anthem countless times, in churches, in schools, my own dinner table, but hearing the harmony of those words reverberate around me in this place, on this day, moved me in a way I had not experienced before. When the crowd sang, "We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered," I thought of how 155 years ago, such a lyric would not have been an abstraction. The blood would not have been metaphoric. I felt as if there was something inside me that had been clenched since Blanford and that I was now able to release. I exhaled, able to breathe in a new way. Over the course of the rest of the program, a procession of community leaders, local politicians, and event organizers came up to the podium at the front of the room to speak about why Juneteenth is important and what it means to them. One of the speeches that stood out was given by Grant Mitchell, a tall, middle-aged white man whose family had sponsored the program for several years. "Today is a day for jubilation," Grant said, leaning on the podium. "We celebrate this day as the day word reached Galveston and then spread throughout the region and into other southern states that freedom had come to millions and a great injustice had been undone. We celebrate the day we got word our great nation, torn apart, but once again united, had taken one bold and decisive step toward fulfilling a promise at the core of its creed, that all people are created equal. But this is not just a celebration. The path toward justice is long and uncertain. It sometimes moves forward and sometimes winds its way back. So today is also a day of reflection. It is a day to look around and ask ourselves, where are we on that path? It is not enough to study history. It is not enough to celebrate singular moments of our past or to lift up the legacies of victories that have been won without understanding the effects of those victories and those losses on the world around us today. The state of Texas currently has a larger Black population than any other state in the country. About 3.5 million Black people call the state home. But as is the case across the country, the Black community experiences profound disparities across income, wealth, education, and criminal justice. Galveston and the state of Texas as a whole extols its history as the origin point of our greatest celebration of emancipation. It is, however, worth interrogating the past century and a half to understand what led to such wide racial chasms in a state that prides itself on its history of freedom. As the program came to an end, I walked from my table across the room to where the Union reenactment soldiers were sitting. I introduced myself to Stephen Duncan and pulled up a chair next to him. Stephen had a round white face with a pair of thin circular glasses that sat high on his nose. His goatee was a mixture of dark gray and white, and when he took off his Union Army cap, he revealed a thinning hairline that extended to the back of his head. Stephen, along with the other four reenactors, was dressed in dark blue Union Army regalia ornamented with gold trimmings. A parade of buttons lined the front of their uniforms and glimmered under the light from the chandelier above. When he spoke, the timbre of his voice was soft and peppered with levity, his intonation that of a neighbor who was always eager to chat. He was an educator in the community, as well as an ordained priest. Stephen told me he joined the Sons of Union Veterans Organization after developing an interest in the Civil War and in more deeply exploring his lineage. When he signed up to start doing reenactment work, he said, "Suddenly everybody who was looking for a Union person would give me a call, which has happened a lot because most of the people in Texas want to be a Confederate reenactor." With the program now over, chatter emanated all around us as people formed lines to get the free breakfast being served. Over the din of post-program conversation, I asked him which of his family members had fought in the war. "I have three great-great-grandfathers who fought in the armies of the North. Had one who was a cavalry private and two who were infantry." He fiddled with a golden button on the bottom of his jacket. "It's such a divisive, horrible time in our history. I mean, we saw the country at its absolute worst. We saw people who thought that It was just fine to hold other people in bondage, he said. And seeing that we struggled through that and made it through the other side seemed really important to me. Talking to Stephen in his Union Army regalia, I was reminded of how the story our country tells about the Civil War often flattens some of its otherwise complex realities. Texas, for example, was a Confederate state, but its citizens were not a monolith. Many Texans were Union sympathizers who did not support the Confederate cause. The same can be said for many Confederate sympathizers in some states loyal to the Union. Sam Houston, for example, who served as the first president of the Republic of Texas, in addition to serving as both senator and governor of the state, opposed secession and unsuccessfully attempted to keep Texas from joining the Confederacy. He was the only governor in the states that would make up the Confederacy to oppose secession in the lead-up to the Civil War. During an 1861 Texas political convention in which the state formally decided to secede from the Union, Houston refused to swear an oath to the Confederacy, writing, "In the name of my own conscience and manhood, I refuse to take this oath." State officials removed Houston from his position as governor, and though Abraham Lincoln reportedly offered him military assistance to prevent Texas from joining the Confederacy, Houston opposed the idea of using force to stay in power. Though he had been considering it long before, Stephen began participating in reenactments around 2012 at the anniversary of the Battle of Bull Run. "It's not a cheap hobby," he said, laughing and noting that his full uniform cost about $1,000. There were limited occasions for him to use his uniform, but in 2015, he was asked by Kathy Tiernan if he would be open to reenacting the role of General Gordon Granger and if he would read General Order No. 3. Stephen jumped at the opportunity. "It's an incredibly cool thing to be able to do," he said, his voice brimming with delight. "I mean, to stand on the steps and say, 'All slaves are free,' has got to be the most powerful four words in history." I asked him what it was like to stand up there and say those words. The first time was absolutely overwhelming. We were outside, and I was up on the balcony, and it felt like 1,000 degrees. And I said, "All slaves are free. Let me say it again. All slaves are free." And they started to chant, "Freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom." Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee was here, and she was leading the chant. And I'm just literally overwhelmed by the power of that. I asked Stephen why he thought more white people didn't participate in Juneteenth events. "They think it's just a black thing," he said. "And my argument is, it's not a black thing. It's an American thing. This is the final bit of freedom for us all. And that's just so important." During our conversation, people came up to Stephen and other sons of Union veterans and thanked them. A number of people asked the uniformed men if they would pose for photos alongside them, which they did enthusiastically. This was something I had not anticipated. "I get people who come up to me a lot," Stephen said. "I'm pretty well known in the community." He took a drink of water. "People will come up and thank me for doing this. I've been known to wear my blue hat in public. I've got two. I've got my chaplain's hat and my general's hat. And I think every African American who sees the blue hat knows exactly what it means. I get a lot of thank yous, a lot of smiles." But not everyone has expressed gratitude to Stephen for what he does here. I'll get snide remarks from time to time from some of the Confederate folks. "Oh, isn't that the wrong color?" they'd say. I told Stephen about my visit just a few weeks prior to Blandford Cemetery and what it was like seeing and speaking with his organizational counterparts, the Sons of Confederate Veterans. "We know them well," he said, nodding his head and briefly tucking his lips inside his mouth. "Some of them are absolutely delightful human beings." He paused. "And some of them don't think the war ended." In many ways, the public spectacle of Juneteenth came to serve as an open rebuke to the emerging lost cause narrative of the late 1800s. How could anyone suggest that the war was not about slavery when black people across the state and across the country were providing annual public reminders of the war's inextricable link to emancipation? As the lost cause mythology continued into the early 20th century, Juneteenth was not only a celebration, but also a seizing of public memory. As historian Elizabeth Hayes Turner notes, "Memories represent power to people who are oppressed. For while they cannot control much of what occurs in their lives, they can own their memories." the earliest iterations of Juneteenth in Texas, which began following the end of the Civil War, ranged from ceremonial readings of the Emancipation Proclamation to black newspapers printing images of Abraham Lincoln in their pages, testaments to a man who had already begun to take on legendary and even mythical status among many in the black community. Other celebrations included church services, in which preachers had the congregation give thanks for their freedom while encouraging them to be relentless in the ongoing struggle for racial equity. Often there were parades, large displays of song and celebration that shook the streets. And in the afternoons, there were massive feasts, the sort of spreads that people looked forward to all year. Spare ribs, fried chicken, black-eyed peas. The smell of collard greens crawled out from between the cracked windows of homes and teased everyone passing by. Recipes for special pastries were exchanged between neighbors and transformed oven into incubators of sugary breaded delight. Children dashed back and forth between one another's houses, hoping to get an early taste from a generous neighbor of the feast that was to come. There were picnics, beauty pageants, baseball games, and an endless stream of songs that emanated throughout the streets. Unfortunately, the public celebrations became less visible. As Republicans abandoned the black community, Reconstruction was dismantled. Black Americans' second-class citizenship was recodified through Jim Crow laws and enforced through the omnipresent threat of violence. And Juneteenth celebrations were not only unwelcome, but often dangerous. With the threat of lynching always there for black Southerners, some celebrations across the country disappeared from public view and into private homes and black churches. As the decades went by and black Americans still had nothing close to full equality, to some, Juneteenth seemed like an unfulfilled promise. In 1941, the Houston Informer, a black newspaper, wrote, "Negroes are not sure whether to be gay on Juneteenth or to observe the day with sadness. They do not know whether they are actually free here." By the early 1970s, Juneteenth celebrations slowly began to reemerge as local cultural organizations throughout Texas and throughout the country began to lift up the holiday as a way to celebrate black culture and black history. In 1979, newly elected Texas State Legislator Al Edwards introduced House Bill 1016, which would make June 19th a state holiday. Over the course of 4 months, Edwards built a diverse coalition of support across the state legislature. As one Juneteenth celebrant put it, "Even if the American people in the United States didn't really set that day aside for us, I believe they owe it to us anyway. They ought to give the colored man a day for his freedom. It should be a red spot on the calendar, and really took a side for." Edwards' campaign proved successful, and in 1979, Texas became the first state to create a holiday in honor of black emancipation. In Ashton Villa, back at the Juneteenth breakfast, Al Edwards Sr. made his way to his seat, his gait frail and unsteady as he hunched over a walker to keep him upright. His movements were labored, his steps precarious, as his son and grandchildren helped him to his seat. Born in Houston in 1937, Edwards was number 6 of 16 children. He graduated from Texas Southern University in 1966 and went on to participate in the civil rights movement alongside Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Jesse Jackson. Edwards is often referred to as the father of Juneteenth because of his advocacy for the holiday. When I sat down to speak with him, his voice was so low and so fragile that I could not understand anything he said. I tried to adjust myself to get as close as possible while still respecting his space, but no adjustment proved helpful. Even though I couldn't hear him, seeing Edwards in person was an important reminder that the stakes of this holiday had once been even greater than they are today. At 82 years old, Edwards had lived in a world where thousands of people who had been born into slavery were still alive. In the Federal Writers Project database, whose interviews of formerly enslaved people took place between 1936 and 1938, I searched for formerly enslaved people interviewed in and around Galveston, whose years on this earth crossed paths with Edwards. Minty Maria Miller, who was born in Tuscaloosa, Alabama in 1852 before moving to Texas, outlined with devastating detail what it was like to stand on the auction block. "They stands me up on a block of wood, and a man bid me in. I felt mad. You see, I was young then, too young to know better. I don't know what they sold me for, but the man what bought me made me open my mouth while he looks in my teeth. They done all us that away. Sells us like you sell a hoss. Josephine Riles was born in Galveston and lived there all her life. She couldn't remember her birthday. Plenty times, the niggas run away because they have to work awful hard and the sun awful hot. They hides in the woods and Mr. Snow keeps nigger dogs to hunt 'em with. Them dogs have big ears and they so bad I never fools round with them. Mr. Snow take off their chains and get the scent of the nigger, and they kept on till they finds them. And sometimes they hurt. I knows they tore the meat off one of them field hands. And William Matthews, who, at 89 during the time of his interview, was able to remember with vivid precision the daily life of someone enslaved. The slaves get out in the field before sunup and work till black dark. Then they come home and have to feel their way in the house with no light. My mammy and daddy field hands. My grandma was a cook and have to get the cook pot about 4 o'clock to get breakfast by daylight. They ate by candles or pine torches. One the black boys stand behind them and hold it while they ate. The quarters is back of the big house and didn't have no floors. They saw plumb on the ground and build like a hog pen. We went right on working after freedom. Old Buck Adams wouldn't let us go. It was way after freedom that the freedom man come and read the paper and tell us not to work no more, lest us get paid for it. I had known that Juneteenth was predicated on the fact that some enslaved people, both in Texas and elsewhere, had gone on working without knowing they were free. Still, it was something different to understand how their enslavers purposefully continued to keep them in bondage. In Jasper, Texas, a woman named Tempe Cummins described what happened to her and her mother. Mother was working in the house, and she cooked too. She says she used to hide in the chimney corner and listen to what the white folks say. When freedom was declared, Master wouldn't tell him. But Mother, she hear him telling Mrs. that the slaves was free, but they didn't know it. And he's not gonna tell him till he makes another crop or two. Cummins said she and her mother escaped soon after. She remembered their master getting his gun and shooting at her mother as they fled. What Cummins would make clear is that the jubilation of June 19, 1865 was for many short-lived. General Granger's proclamation did not bring about the immediate liberation of enslaved people in Galveston or in Texas. As historian W. Caleb McDaniel has said about the days, weeks, and years following Juneteenth, slavery did not end cleanly or on a single day. It ended through a violent, uneven process. As word spread about the general order and formerly enslaved people attempted to step into freedom, there were many whites who began pulling them right back. The former Confederate mayor of Galveston even rounded up black runaways in order to return them to their owners, despite the labels owner and runaway having no legal merit. One couldn't be a runaway if they were, under the law, free. Many Southerners felt differently. To further complicate the matter, the Union Army officials did not consistently enforce the rights of formerly enslaved people. Beyond Galveston, formerly enslaved people in Texas did not immediately learn of their emancipation. The geography of the state and the fact that so many were held in remote areas meant that plenty of them simply did not hear about the proclamation for weeks or months or in some cases years. As Turner writes, even those who did hear about it had little opportunity to take advantage of it if their enslavers were non-compliant. Rural and remote locations made it difficult to seek refuge behind Union Army lines. Those who did try to leave, like Tempe Cummins and her mother, were often unsuccessful. White vigilantes often rounded up and punished formerly enslaved people who sought to escape. Making matters even more difficult was the fact that Texas was the last state to receive assistance from the Freedmen's Bureau, set up to provide aid to formerly enslaved black people and impoverished white people throughout the South after the Civil War, with officers from the Bureau arriving more than 2 months after General Granger issued his general order in Galveston. Further, freed people were barred from assembling in groups until members of the Freedmen's Bureau arrived. Former Confederates throughout the South were unwilling to allow formerly enslaved black people to transition smoothly and safely to freedom. They often turned to violence, believing they should have been, at the very least, compensated for their loss of property. A woman named Susan Merritt of Russ County, Texas, reported that, quote, "Lots of Negroes were killed after freedom, bushwhacked, shot down while they were trying to get away. You could see lots of Negroes hanging from trees in Sabine Bottom right after freedom. They would catch them swimming across Sabine River and shoot them." Merritt also described how one day, a man representing the government showed up and told all the black workers that they were free. Still, after the man read the paper telling us we were free, Master made us work several months after that. He said we got 20 acres land and a mule, but we didn't get it. When freedom did eventually come, it often still felt out of reach. There was little financial support for the formerly enslaved, and they were given few resources with which to build economic and social mobility. As Felix Haywood said, "We knowed freedom was on us, but we didn't know what was to come with it. We thought we was going to get rich like the white folks. We thought we was going to be richer than the white folks, because we was stronger and knowed how to work, and the whites didn't, and they didn't have us to work for them anymore. But it didn't turn out that way. We soon found out that freedom could make folks proud, but it didn't make them rich." In 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, black Americans owned about 0.5% of the total wealth in the United States. Today, despite being 13% of the population, black people own less than 4% of the nation's wealth. Despite the role black Americans played in generating this country's wealth, they don't have access to the vast majority of it. At the Juneteenth event, I watched Al Edwards II speak gently to his father and greet each person who approached his dad with a soft, though warm, enthusiasm. Al II's voice was low and raspy, like the thin layer of sand that cakes the sidewalk near a beach. He lives in New Orleans with his family, but would regularly make trips to Houston to spend time with his aging father. Even before he attempted to turn the holiday into a statewide celebration in 1979, Al Edwards Sr. had embarked on a campaign to get people to understand the day's significance. He attended churches, did radio spots, and visited community organizations and schools to spread the gospel of Juneteenth. He wanted to take the holiday away from the relatively small house gatherings and secluded celebrations that had marked the previous decades. He wanted to get enough people out in the streets so that, as his son put it, the city and state could see that a significant amount of our people found it important enough to be recognized and celebrated. I imagined a young Al Edwards Sr. making his way into the state capitol building, the hot Texas sun beating down on him as beads of sweat slid down from his face and onto the collar of his three-piece suit. The passage of the Juneteenth bill was far from certain. It was a 99-to-1 chance, his son told me. It would take passionate hand-wringing and savvy backroom deals. He only needed 50% plus one, Al said, which meant he needed significant Republican support. These were people who had built careers on political ideas that were harmful to black people. But Edwards Sr. knew that politics, particularly politics in Texas, could never be built on purity. It demanded you not let old grudges or personal distaste stand in the way. In exchange for their support, Edwards Sr. promised Republican lawmakers he would be on their side when they needed him. He was staking his legislative career on the Juneteenth bill's success. "It takes that sometimes," his son said. "It's not enough to be right all the time. It's not enough to be right sometimes. Sometimes you also have to be a benefit to those who you need a benefit from." For Edwards Sr., any compromises or sacrifices he made were worth it. He had marched with Dr. King, and making Juneteenth a state holiday was an extension of the work put into motion by the Civil Rights Movement. The holiday would not be established by its official recognition. The Edwards family had always celebrated the holiday, but the legislation provided institutional legitimacy to a community that had been denied it for so long. Edwards Sr. kept pushing, kept hand-wringing, kept arm-twisting, kept sacrificing, and it paid off. He got the votes he needed. Only 7 years old when Juneteenth became a Texas state holiday in 1980, Al II did not fully understand the significance of everything that was transpiring with the legislation, but he knew that something significant had just happened. Of course, back then, those details didn't land anywhere with a 7-year-old, said Al. But when Martin Luther King Day was declared a federal holiday a few years later, we sort of realized the significance of that first African-American state holiday being passed as part of a national history, not just for the state alone. How it was the precursor for entertaining the entire push for a national holiday around African-American recognition. So you think your father's Juneteenth bill was something that propelled the Martin Luther King Jr. Day bill? I asked him, unfamiliar with the relationship between the two. Absolutely, he said. It made it more palatable and more defensible to have a national holiday named for an African-American of Martin Luther King's significance. But it was sort of the natural progression. But it took that first thrust for it to get that first thing across the finish line. I was curious as to whether or not his father, following passage of the bill, had had a sense of how significant the law would go on to be and how important it was in the larger context of the fight to have this country recognize what black people have had to overcome. I think for lawmakers in that period of time, between Jim Crow and the turn of the century, there was so much transition. So he may have spent less time thinking about what the long term or big picture was, and more time just in the fight itself. So I don't think he spent a lot of time reflecting on it because at every turn someone was trying to beat it back, he said, his voice becoming firm. I think he spent more time in the work of it than he spent sort of admiring it. He knew that it needed to be visible, and it needed to be stoked and kept alive, and it needed to be illuminated in the minds of our people especially, because if it was left untended, it was definitely going to be driven back. He always had that concern. Reflecting on what celebrations after the first official Juneteenth were like, he said, "It was a totally different thing. We had fireworks. It was a big deal because Dad was giving it the relevance and significance that U.S. Independence Day has, because it was essentially our Independence Day, and he wanted to make sure that people understood that we do view it that way, just as the rest of the nation views the 4th of July. Al's comment made me think of Frederick Douglass's famous 4th of July speech in 1852, in which he stated, "Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you, this day, rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you."